And tonight, our special guest is Whitley Strieber as we talk about his latest work, Hybrids. And we're going to get way into this in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Whitley, do you think the people could take it if they knew we were being visited, that some people were being altered, that there were hybrid babies? Do you think people could handle that?
Absolutely not.
No, not at all.
No, I don't think so, and nor should they. If we were privy to information like that, there are a lot of things that we would also, I think, therefore, which we have the right to know now, but we don't, because we're kept in. If that is really being done, then certainly, I've always said that my knowledge, I have a lot of knowledge of this, of our government, the way it works, like anybody does. I'm not special in any way, but we've all been living with it all of our lives. And it's actually a fairly open organization. It's got too much secrecy, that's true, as a legacy of the Cold War. But something this big, if there was one central place where all of the information was gathered, it'd be leaking out a lot. Actually, there's a lot of information in a lot of different places, and nobody knows exactly what it's all about. It might be something lost in the National Archives that's of earth-shattering importance. Nobody even knows it. But somebody does know, and that is whoever's on the other side of the curtain doing this. Yeah. And I think they're the ones that are behind all the secrecy, and they keep us in a state of confusion, so that we won't ask the wrong questions.
See, and I'm not even sure governments really know what's going on.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen a hybrid?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you a couple of stories. The first one is a very interesting one. I mean, they're both interesting as they can be. The first one takes place in Mexico. And at that time, this must have been in the early 90s, I had never seen what I would describe as a hybrid, not consciously anyway. I apparently had them at my book signings, but I didn't notice them. Any case, there was a woman there. I went to a UFO conference, and she said that she had made love with an alien in Costa Rica, and that this alien had looked human and had gotten her out of her trailer where she and her husband were sleeping, and had taken her somewhere, she didn't know where, and made love with her. And there had been a baby. In fact, this had so enraged her husband that he had left her.
Oh my God.
And she introduced me to the baby, who was now a young teenager. And this girl was really remarkable. She was, first of all, brilliant, very brilliant. And second, she was extremely nice. She was a very kind human being. She was so fragile that you looked like you could just crush her like a piece of Kleenex. I mean, she was very fragile looking. Great big eyes. And
yeah.
Thin, ethereal, lovely person.
Pale.
Oh, pale, yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself at the time, maybe that's true in this case. Maybe this is true. And I wrote the book The Grays, and in that book there's a child who might be a hybrid, and incredibly, bizarrely, the child's in this losing certain part of the country. And I got into communication with someone whose child's life, living in the same part of the country, seems in a curious way to follow my novel. In other words, the child in the novel seems like it might be actually a real person that I have some unconscious knowledge of. And this child, she believes her child is a hybrid. Not all of them have been so nice, but I do know something about them. You alluded earlier in the program to this question of why, what would them that would make them different.
Right.
And there is something about us and the visitors that is fundamentally different that makes the two societies, the visitors I know, the Greys, are new. I haven't seen them in a long time. And that was that they could communicate with thought. Now, whether this was done with technology or not, I don't know. We're on the point of being able to do it with technology ourselves now. So maybe they had implanted similar technology into their own heads. I don't know. But they could communicate this way, and they often would communicate with me this way. And if you think about that, how different a world it would be if we all knew each other's thoughts. Privacy would have a whole different meaning. Crime would be a completely different thing. The hidden motives of politicians would be exposed. It would be a completely different world. More truthful, but in a sense more desperate, because we would have to learn to hide the parts of ourselves that need hiding. And this is a fallen world, like it says in the Bible. And there are parts of all of us that need hiding for that reason. We would have a lot of trouble with that. But some of the hybrids that I encountered seemed able to read the mind, human-looking ones.
At will.
At will. And I thought, in fact, that one of them, at least, had kind of gone mad because of this. Because I had a feeling that, I can't prove it, but that he couldn't tune it out. He had a lot of symptoms of schizophrenia. But he was physically not enough like us to be human. He wasn't completely human. I can tell you a little bit about him. He was the first time that I ever encountered him was in the woods behind my old cabin, way back in the woods. And I was walking out there. It was a hot August afternoon, very dry. And I saw a child smoking a cigarette. And I thought, well, no, that's not good. I went over there. I mean, it's not my business if someone else's child is smoking. But in my woods, it is, especially when they're that dry. And it looked like about an 11-year-old. So I went over to tell him basically to put it out. And I got close to him, and it was very clear that this is not a child. I was about a mile back in the woods all by myself. It was afternoon. And this is something else. He was a small adult, but you know, clearly an older person when I got close to him. If somebody was defective in some way and never reached puberty and just got older and older and older,
he'd look like him.
They'd look like him, yeah. And I've talked about him on the coast a couple times. And in any case, I leaned over and I started to still kind of going on my old rails. You know, I never expect anything unusual to happen. I talk about crazy. I must be nuts by this. Why not? Why I should expect everything unusual to happen all the time.
Sure.
But anyway, I'm there and I'm doing my thing. It's a child and it's in my woods. He's in my woods. He's smoking. Shouldn't be. I lean over and I start to tell him to stop smoking. And he's sitting there. He's staring straight ahead. And I suddenly get the feeling that, you know, I've come up like, you might feel if you come up on a mountain lion and you realize, I'm a little closer to this
very little
deadly creature than I thought I should be, and I better get out of here.
What have I gotten myself into, right?
Right, and he opens his mouth and he lets out this low growl. And I thought,
whoa,
time to move off.
Yeah.
I turned around and I hightailed it back to the house because I was far out in the woods. And told Annie about it, and We didn't know whether we had a stalker or not. We actually ended up calling the Criminal Investigation Division of the state police because, you know, he showed up a couple more times in the woods.
Yeah.
And he smoked constantly.
That's a little jarring. After a while.
Yeah, and we thought in terms of a stalker. You know, we were thinking it was...
Or worse, right?
I mean, a stalker starts out as a stalker, but why is he stalking you?
Yeah.
It can't be a... The reason can't be good. It's like the person who arrives knocks on your hotel room door after midnight when you're on tour. It's not going to be a good experience.
That's right.
So that was what we thought, that was what we're dealing with. But over time, time, because of the way he acted and the things he did, it was very clear to me that he was reading my mind. He knew my mind. He's not the only one who was able to do that. By the time we moved down to Texas, we were in this little condo, and I was lying in the bed one afternoon, pretty tired, and taking a nap. And suddenly I hear this voice in my mind, like a radio, and I'd heard that from the visitors before once or twice, saying, that threatening to kidnap me and stuff, really scary stuff. But it was not, I was, you know, it was not a symptom. In other words, it was literally like, sounded like I was wearing earphones, only I didn't have any on. And I jumped out of the bed and immediately ran out onto the little porch, which was looked right onto the street after past a little garden. And there were two guys there. And they ran back to the street to their car, jumped into it, two men. I didn't get a close enough look at them to see whether or not I would think they were anything but human. It was a black Mustang. They jumped into it. And they drove away very quickly. And they had been doing something to project thought into my mind in order to terrorize me, to frighten me. And I don't know who they were. I do have a fairly good idea that they used an instrument that may actually exist in our, we may possess such an instrument. There's someone, it's been tested before even, and it can project microwaves sound or into what appears to make it appear as if it's in your head. In the same way that if you use a stereo headphone and you adjust it just right, it feels like sounds like the sound is right in the middle of your head. This works mm-hmm. the same way.
That's right.
And apparently it's a real instrument. And it was probably some people from the local military base horsing around with me, you know, who had gotten a hold of something they should never have been playing with. That's probably all it was. But I think that if there are people being hybridized, that part of what's being done to them is that they are able to read thoughts.
Could they be injected into society for, let's say, running for political office, running companies, and they're all over the place?
If they're all over the place, somebody is definitely not playing with a full deck of cards because we're in too much trouble for them to be any good at what they do.
Yeah, that's right. They're screwing up.
I mean, if I had that ability, I'd be in Vegas. Why not? I mean, yeah. You know, I'd be a poker champion.
Yeah, yeah. Or roulette, or whatever you do.
Well, I mean, poker, because of the fact that if you could read
read everybody's
minds. Minds of the other players, you'd be able to just whoop them.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Good point. And so you don't think they're injected into society? Then?
No, I don't agree there. I do think they might be.
Really?
Okay. Certainly. I don't see why not. I think that would be one of the objectives. If you know, I always try to think to myself, what if the roles are reversed and we are the star-traveling species who find another less advanced species that we can that are in trouble? We want them to survive. We also want to study them. We want to perhaps exploit them. And what we don't want to have happen is for them to realize that we're there, because that will turn them into supplicants. In other words, if we knew the visitors were there, were real, if everyone knew this after they had gotten over all the caterwauling that would be going on, and it would be considerable. I mean, I did a lot of it when I first discovered they were real. But once we got over that, we'd all be saying, hey, what can we get out of this? They're traveling the stars. They're doing this. They're doing that. We'd like this. We'd like that. But to them, it would be like a bunch of primitive people trying to get a hold of the beads and the shiny cooking pots. In other words, we'd be useless. There'd be nothing new coming from us out anymore. So they would probably... If we were going to another planet, our anthropologists would be saying, fine, do what you want to do, but don't let them know you're there. So we would develop things that would put them out when we were near them so that we could carry out whatever we wanted to carry out and without them knowing it or understanding it. And they might have things that are valuable. It might be very valuable to take home their sexual material, to clone versions of them here on our planet so that we could have them among us. They might be immensely, that might be something somebody would pay a great deal to have. So it wouldn't have rights, wouldn't be human, so it'd be like an animal. Might be brilliant, might be more intelligent than we are. But under the law, if it's not human, it's an animal, and you have a whole lot more latitude with what you can do with an animal than with a human being.
Ridley, what do you think the procedure is for creating these hybrids? Is it what we've heard, you know, taking the, you know, impregnating the woman, taking the fetus out, raising it somewhere? Are they doing it like that?
All I can tell you is what happened to me. I mean, I know a lot of those stories. I've read thousands of letters. My wife's read God knows how many letters with all that stuff in it. What happened to me was this, and I can be real precise about it at this point. I've taken this a long way. I had this thing put into me, which was called an electrostimulator. They use them in animal husbandry now. In those days, they were also, and you notice, this is, I'm not talking about high tech here. They were also used in sexual clinics for people who were having trouble. They use Viagra now for the same purpose. But this caused an immediate physical response, and they harvested my semen from my body and took it. I saw it done with
off
my own eyes.
Okay, so they take it. Where do they go with it?
Well, you know, one of the most insightful people I know, I mean, who knows a lot about this stuff and is very brilliant, said to me, you know, Whitley, I wonder if that wasn't your son back there in that woods.
That's interesting.
And that kind of stopped me. Because, you know, I tried so hard to make something work there. I knew this person was there, George.
Yeah.
All the time. It wasn't like there once and then gone. We'd hear him. We'd glimpse him out there. We'd find places where he used to stand and smoke cigarettes. He smoked constantly, like, you know, somebody who has mental, like schizophrenics, their symptoms are relieved by constant cigarette smoking.
Did he look like he was living outside or anything like that?
Yeah, he sure did. He didn't look, and that's the interesting, he didn't look dirty. I could never find out where he physically was living, but he was out there all the time, day and night. You know, the air would get very still there, and you would smell the cigarette smoke in the mornings early around dawn, and he would have come up near the house and been close to the house.
He was close, yeah.
Oh, but listen, he moved down to Texas with us, too. He didn't stay when we left. He came. He showed up there about six weeks later.
He showed up and you saw him?
Oh, yes. Yeah, George. You know,
you had to think he was stalking you at this point, didn't you?
Of course we did.
Yeah.
He was not intimidating enough, though. He's too small, frankly. I mean, I probably should have been more scared of him than I was. But after we got used to, when we were still in New York, we saw him often enough to where not Annie so much. We went out in the woods looking for him together one time, but she was never too keen on that kind of thing.
Hold on for a second, Whitley. We're going to take this break in a second. I want to come back and talk about this story. This is incredible, and it's bizarre. And we'll get more into Whitley Strieber's book, Hybrids, in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, let me tell you, for the first 50 people who subscribe to unknowncountry.com for 1 year for Whitley, he's going to give you a free autographed copy of this brand new book, Hybrids. The first 50 people who go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe to it. We'll be back. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Whitley Strieber. Perhaps you're a hybrid. Check in with us. But we'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go back a little bit, Whitley. So this person, this creature, whatever it is, you moved to Texas with Ann. It shows up. How soon?
It was about 6 weeks, and understand what the situation now is. It's been in the woods in upstate New York. I've gone out there. I've gone out with cameras. I've tried to take pictures. And I have, unfortunately, in those days, DNA testing was just in its infancy.
Right.
And it had, this thing had left, this person, I shouldn't say thing, had left cigarette butts. It would stand and smoke endlessly. And it had left these piles. We'd find these piles of cigarette butts out there. And that was why we called the police, because we were very, very nervous about it at first. And, you know, they didn't do anything whatsoever. I mean, they couldn't have cared less, but they saw the evidence.
Well, that's frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always been very frustrating with them. As soon as they hear it's Whitley Strieber, they, you know, as far as they're concerned, no crime has been committed, and there's nothing to worry about. If I do just disappear, then goodbye.
So be it, right?
So be it, exactly. So in any case, it had been in the woods, or he had been in the woods. It had been very shy, very hard to try to, any attempt to approach him failed. And but quite close to the house, often we once went skinny dipping, Ann and I used to. The pool was, our little pool there was very private. And he runs up and down in the woods behind, you can't see him, it's all leafed out, and so it's, you can't see it, gasping and breaking sticks and stuff, like it's just the worst thing in the world that we're doing. And finally we just went inside because, you know, we didn't feel very comfortable. Anyway, we go down to Texas. We move down there. We're now in a little condo, and it's a sad move, but in some ways it was a relief, because after all we'd been living a very, very strange life for a long time at that point. And one night, and we're on the ground floor, on the end of a building. The next building is about 4 feet or 5 feet away across a little tiny alley that's so narrow you could barely even walk through it, maybe 6 feet away. And one night I smelled cigarette smoke, and I think, oh, God, you know, we're living in a condo, and somebody's smoking, and it's not like it used to be. And so I ignore it for a couple nights. And then there was we had a little screen porch, and you walked down on that porch, and to your left was a cul-de-sac where the screen porch came out, and then the side of the building that was right up against our bedroom was right there, and about 4 feet back, and there was a little L-shaped cul-de-sac. I went out the door, and there were all these cigarette butts in the cul-de-sac. I couldn't believe my eyes. I knew what they were. I'd seen them, those piles of things, the things in the woods time and again.
You must have had a gulp in your throat.
Oh, I was flabbergasted.
Yeah.
So the next night, I jump up in the middle of the night. I smell cigarettes. So I jump up in the middle of the night and just rush out onto the screen porch. And this figure rushes away and off down the alley like a shot, gone. So I put a motion-sensitive light in there. Oh, no, other things were happening first. This went on for a few days. It went on for a couple of weeks, actually, before I actually put in the motion-sensitive light. But we noticed that he, or some neighbors noticed, rather, that the first one man saw him jump off of a balcony into the pool. And it was impossible. You couldn't do it because you'd have to take a running jump or you'd hit the ground. And so he was talking away about that, you can be sure. And then some other people saw him go up a wall and pull spokes out of somebody's bicycle on a tire on the second floor of one of the other buildings. Then some people lived across from us said that people had been calling state social services because of this strange child. And I thought, oh, boy, I'm so hopeful they don't decide. They don't connect it with me. I don't really need that. I've already got enough of a bad reputation with most people. They did not like having me around. They found me scary. And you're in here, and you know you can't get out, so you don't feel scary. But other people, they did find me scary. So anyway, we're there in the condo, and Ann and I were out walking one night. And we used to walk between like 1 and 2 in the morning because it was so hot in Texas. Couldn't walk during the day. back, and we come back over a little hill down a street, and there's a strip mall that we where the drugstore and the grocery store and stuff are. And there are these. There's this guy standing in front of the drugstore, just exuded evil. George, it stopped us. It was like being hit in the face with pure evil. We were at least 100, maybe 300, 400 feet away from him. And he was in an overcoat in the middle of the summer. It was hot. We were in shorts. And I said to Ann, we can't go near that. And she said, I know that. And he was making a what looked like a kind of hobo mark with a cigar on the door of the drugstore. And we went way around another block and got very happy to get home, let me tell you.
Yeah, I would guess so.
So then, next day, I'm in the store, and I see him in the store. I thought, oh, God. And then there's another guy with him, and they're stealing tobacco products blatantly. And
I wonder if they eat them.
I don't know. And I thought, holy moly, it's those creatures. These aren't people. And that one of them looked at me just immediately, as soon as I had that thought, with a horrific stare. Wherever they come from, it's not a place I want to go. I'll tell you that.
That is certain. Very, very fast.
So I left the store immediately and went home. The next couple days, I saw them around the condo complex, and I found out they were living in this apartment right behind us, and they had the little boy, the child, was with them.
How bizarre.
And so I thought to myself, this is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, so they had to have been making some kind of money.
Well, no. Here's what happened. I quickly found out from the management who owned that condo, because I was on it. I mean, I had solid evidence, perhaps, finally, of something. And I called the guy, lived in Houston. He says, well, wait a minute. What are you talking about? There's no one living in my condo.
Ah.
I said, yeah, there's three people living in your condo.
Squatters.
And he said, they're squatters. Exactly. And so a few days pass. He called me back. Are they still there? I said, yeah, they're still there. He said, well, the sheriff's coming tomorrow. He's going to get rid of them. And that afternoon, they go around the condo. The two guys did. The little fellow was not there. Around the condo complex, trying to sell a man's furniture to everyone. I mean, we all knew they didn't belong there. It wasn't a secret among us anymore. So no one bought his furniture, of course, and they were flushed out. But here's what happened with the little fella, and this is the last of him in my life. I installed a motion-sensitive light in that cul-de-sac, and the first night I installed it, that light went off and on. This was a couple nights before they moved out. Off and on, off and on, off and on, and you could hear him going back and forth and trying to deal with it and not being able to. And so he may have been an alien or whatever he was from somebody. He couldn't figure out how to turn off that light. There was no switch on it on the outside, of course, except for the motion sensor. And then the morning that the two guys were evicted, I was out in my little garden weeding, and the little one, short one, comes bursting out of that little alley and goes stalking off down the middle of the street, and never saw him again. The two fellows were evicted. The apartment was cleaned up, and that was an end of it. Never saw any of them again.
That is a strange story. Are humans helping aliens with all of this?
Well, they must be. Otherwise, who put this thing in my ear?
Yeah, somebody's.
Can you believe you're having a conversation like this when I have it? I think to myself, how could your life possibly have been this strange?
Well, first of all, I've known you for years now. If this was my first conversation with you and I knew nothing about you, I would go, this is one of the strangest conversations I've ever had.
Yeah. I mean, I've been living in the Twilight Zone for years. And I'm used to it, but I'm not used to it at the same time. I might, by the way, I keep forgetting to mention this to the listeners. You can go to the website called hybridsbook.com and learn more about the book. And do go there, because it's the man, James Beeson, who does my websites, did a marvelous job. It's got a great video about hybrids on it. There's readings where you can hear me read the first three chapters of the book. There's a link on coasttocoastam.com that links to the first chapter of the book, and which is, so it's a beautiful website, hybridsbook.com. And do go and take a look, and you can also see where you could go to your local bookstore. There's things you can find at your local Borders or Barnes & Noble or your local independent bookstore from there. Go and get it. Or you can get it for your Kindle or Nook or iPad, too, online.
This is a movie. You know that. It's going to be a movie.
I don't know that. I don't know how, you know, Hollywood loves alien stuff, and they should do it. But the whiff of it possibly being something real might kind of put them off. I hope not. I hope somebody buys it. It really should. There's certainly a great role in it for an actor, and it's also a love story. It's, you know what, I write these books, I call them true fictions.
Right, they're based on fact.
It contains elements that I think are factual, but I don't have enough information to prove.
Right.
So I call them true fiction. So if you want to learn what I really think is going on, you got to read books like Majestic and The Greys and Hybrids. And that's kind of exposes all the secrets.
I have always thought that one day, Whitley, they've made tens of millions of these hybrids, and they've got them on another planet or in a spaceship somewhere. And one day they're going to dump them all down on this planet.
No, we don't need that.
We don't need
that. We've already got the Gulf is full of oil. The air is full of radioactivity from Fukushima. We don't need to be polluted by a bunch of crazed hybrids either.
What if they're replacing us?
Well, that's unfortunate, because we're better than that. We have compassion, decency, dignity, love. We are not at the edge of madness or a little bit beyond it.
Whitley, if you were on the outside looking in and you saw what was going on this planet, historically, I don't think you'd think we were very compassionate.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe if you were on the outside looking in and could only see what we did, mm-hmm. not what we were inside, you might think this was a planet of monsters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, they're making nuclear bombs. They're doing this.
Right.
They're killing each other. We got to get rid of them.
George, let's hope that doesn't happen.
I know it, but it's possible. It is absolutely possible. You dedicate, acknowledge our dear friend and your wife, Ann Strieber, who did yeoman's work working on some scientific papers for you and doing some research into this as well. She enjoys doing that, doesn't she?
Ann is a terrific researcher. She's brilliant. And, you know, I'm struggling away with something, and she says, oh, here it is. She's so quick mentally. She's a really brilliant person, and not only that, she's a very compassionate, open-minded human being. So when this first happened to me, when I first had the first close encounter, I told a friend of mine, Timothy Greenfield Saunders, about it before I told Ann. Because, you know, how do you tell your wife a thing like that? And I told Timothy, and I said to Timothy, I'm going to have to tell Ann, and I can't figure out how to tell her. And he said, just tell her. She'll probably figure it all out before you can. It's probably not even that much of a mystery.
If any wife could to handle this, it would be her.
Yeah. She was relieved, actually, because at the time I thought I was going crazy, and I was very, very upset. And once she knew what it actually was, she felt like it was something that we could handle.
Was it a relief for you to tell her?
Oh, yeah. It was a tremendous relief to tell her. Because she had, you know, I had been keeping the secret from her. And I thought I had initially, of course, like everyone, I thought, oh, God, it's brain tumor. I've got cancer. And then when that proved not to be the case, I took an MRI scan and everything. And I told, finally, I told my doctor, I went in to him initially with the symptoms of, I didn't even tell him the first visit about the rape. I just told him I was having headaches, and I got the MRI scan. And finally, I said to him, I told him what I remembered from that night. And he examined me for the rape, and he said, "You've been raped." And at first, I told him the story, and he says, "Well, you're telling me you're taking over a flying saucer by little men." And I said, "I am?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well," he said, "maybe we should think about seeing a psychiatrist." I said, "Well, you're right, Tom. Maybe we should." And I thought, holy moly, I'm crazy. And I didn't want to tell Ann that. I didn't want, and I started trying to kind of get her to divorce me or something. I loved her terribly, but I didn't want her to go through that with me. And then he says to me, after I went back, because I had a lot of pain and physical pain, and he did say, he said, "Well, you've been raped." And he said, "This is not, whatever it is, it's also a crime. Someone has committed a crime here." And my initial thought when I finally went to Dr. Donald Klein, the psychiatrist, was I went to him because Bud Hopkins found him, and he is a specialist in forensic psychiatry.
Well, and Bud's one of the best.
Oh, Bud was a great guy. I mean, we have had a big, long, lifelong fight for some reason I've never been able to figure out, but he's the one who brought this all into focus, I mean, with his book Intruders.
Well, that's
so
true.
It must never be forgotten. Before we go on too much longer, we're getting up toward the top of the hour, George, and I want to bring up another aspect of the whole hybrid story. It's a very, very interesting one, and we can talk about it more in the next hour.
Yeah, go ahead. We got a couple minutes here.
Yeah, and that's the Lloyd Pye, Star Child.
Oh, yeah, know him well.
He's back in the, I guess in the fall, he was on Coast, and he's been often on my show. And he's got some new DNA material on his website. I'm planning to have him back on, and we probably both should. But he's really proved the skull is not of this world, and to the point that there are now debunkers trying to say it's all a big hoax, which I know it isn't. I've held the skull in my hands. It's certainly not a hoax.
No. If anything, the DNA testing could be wrong. It's not a hoax. Lloyd Pye would not hoax this.
No, he's not a hoaxer. He's been working with this for years and has grown old with it. And in any case, he's found now four fragments of mitochondrial DNA have been sequenced, and their total base pair count is 10% of the number of base pairs found in the mitochondria of human beings. In other words, the Star Child's mitochondrial DNA, as he explains here in some detail, has 910 differences with the human DNA. It is not even in the ballpark of
That's
being
huge.
Human.
Whitley, we'll come back. We'll take some phone calls and continue chatting about your latest work, Hybrids. Get ready to make some calls. Whitley Strieber, our guest on Coast to Coast AM.